Good morning, everybody. Today, the focus is on Latinos or Hispanics in the United States. One thing that strikes me, or that's just a social reality, is that the United States is a country of immigrants. It's a country of immigrants, period. It's one of the most unique places in world history where you had this incredible landmass that had a very small population of people, Native Americans. And there was a crisis that was happening globally, and people were seeking refuge by leaving their country of origin and coming to the U.S., and there was no border patrols. It was just open land, free expanse. There were people living here, but it was very loosely populated, and people immigrated. And like we hear in the news today about the immigration crisis, whether it be the U.S.-Mexico border, or in Europe with Syrians and Iranians or Iraqis immigrating into Europe. This happens all the time. Immigration occurs. And in the U.S. is very unique in its origins in that there just wasn't border patrol. There wasn't an established government in place deciding, well, which people should we let in and which people should we keep out or which people should we deport. It was just open access. People just sort of came. And there was no discussion about whether or not they should come or not. And so the only people that are not immigrants to the United States are the Native Americans and then also African Americans. They didn't necessarily immigrate to the United States. They were brought here through the slave trade. But apart from that, everyone else at some point or another immigrated to the United States. You are immigrants in many respects. So when you think about the term immigrant and you have certain perceptions of what an immigrant is and your feelings about immigrants, you have to recognize that you yourself are most likely a child of an immigrant, or your family origins are ones of immigrants. And I want you to just right now write down on a piece of paper, think back to your grandparents, your great-grandparents, your great-great-grandparents, or something within your family ancestry, and try and trace back your family's country of origin or countries of origin. And you might be sitting there thinking, I have no idea, I'm just American. But you maybe have heard in discussions during family reunions like, oh, I'm part Dutch and part Irish, or my mom was Italian and my dad was German. Or, you know, there's something in your lineage that will maybe help trace back your countries of origin. Some of you might be first generation. You're the first one in your family to have come to the United States, or you're the first one in your family to be born in the United States. Or you might be able to trace it back to seven generations of when your family immigrated. So try and identify what your family's countries of origin are. And write it down. And I want you to turn. We're going to do this in pairs again. Make sure you pair up with someone. And share your story of your family's lineage and origins and how they arrived in the United States. And if you don't know, that can be part of your story as well. And maybe an inspiration to try and figure out, well, what is my origin? Because no one just was here unless you were Native American. So pair up with someone and share your story of your origins. So does anyone have an interesting story of your origins? Or, I mean, I think they're all interesting because they're part of your lineage and your own story, but can anyone just sort of share a unique or particularly interesting part of your origins? Yes, Olivia.
So I don't know how to trace it back, but my uncle's hand on my mom's side, that we're actually directly related to Pocahontas.
Huh. How did you guys trace that back?
I don't know. It's my great uncle who can do it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how he did it. I just know he did it.
Yeah, that's great. Anyone else have just interesting stories of the bringing together people from two different countries or a situation of how they arrived here in the U.S.? Or is anyone a first or second generation U.S. citizen, or even potentially not a U.S. citizen? You're here as an international student. Ewan?
Yeah. Well, I'm originally from Scotland. I'm a permanent resident right now. But up to like three generations before me are from Scotland as well. And then I was saying, I think before that, they're originally from Ireland.
Oh, okay. I barely know my family's journey. I know they came over on a ship. If they didn't come from England or Scotland, they probably didn't know English. And so they're being immersed in a culture where English was the predominant language. It wasn't the only language. German and French and other languages were spoken. But there were the same challenges that modern-day immigrants would face. And even finding a job or being less educated than the general population or finding a job outside of your field of expertise because you weren't credentialed. You might have been credentialed in your home country but not credentialed in the United States. And so you had to find a job that was a lower-skilled job. And so just to sort of demystify this idea of immigrants or the idea that immigrants are somewhat some kind of other person, I think it's helpful to recognize that at one point or another, most of us in this room have immigrant origins. And there's implications for that. I mean, we tend to forget that because after you've been here for multiple generations, it's like, well, no, I'm American. And all these other people are the immigrants. But in reality, most of us were immigrants. Now, I said that the only people who weren't immigrants are the Native Americans and also African Americans. But then there's a third group that in some ways dwelled here and lived here, but then at some point the land was taken over by the United States, and so the people all of a sudden became foreigners in their own land, and that's the Mexican population. And there's an interesting aspect of history. I think it was covered a little bit in the book, but this video I'm going to show you just shows you reality of sort of, well, gosh, are there some people of Mexican origin in the U.S. who actually have claim on the land that we now call the United States? Like, did we sort of take their land and then all of a sudden relabel them as immigrants and as foreigners?
At one time, the land in New Mexico, along with California, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, Texas, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming, belonged to Mexico. In 1846, the United States declared war on Mexico. 2 years later, the war was over, and Mexico had lost half its territory. Overnight, 100,000 Mexicans became foreigners on soil that had belonged to their families for generations. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo promised these new Americans free enjoyment of their liberty and property of every kind. But the original land grants had been given under Spanish and Mexican law, which U.S. courts often did not recognize. Over the years, Mexican Americans lost their land to speculators, lawyers, and cattle barons. Some property was taken by force. By 1960, millions of acres, including the Tierra Amarilla grant, had been taken from the original landowning families.
I think it's important to know the history of the U.S., and a lot of times when we think of immigrants, hey, go back to Mexico, is sometimes the common theme. But in reality, someone of Mexican origin can sit there and say, well, actually, this is our land, but it was taken by force. Now, you'd say, well, that's just a part of conquest, and so the U.S. won the war, and so we have claim on that land. But there are people living, you know, it's like someone coming into your home community and conquering your community and saying, okay, your home is no longer your home. Get out. You're trespassing. And you're just kind of like, well, wait a minute, that's just wrong, that's unjust. And so a lot of this narrative about immigrants and immigration, and especially amongst the Latino and Hispanic population, it's a much more complex story. It isn't just, you know, speed up to the year 2015 and think, well, should we allow people across the border or not? There's a long history that dates back hundreds of years. And that influences current policies, but a lot of times we forget about what happened over time. And so there's been tremendous migration flows in the U.S., and especially related to Hispanic and Latino population, But what we don't know about is not only is there migration flow into the U.S., but then there's also deportations and repatriations. And so when Donald Trump talks about wanting to deport all people of Latino or Hispanic origins, wanting to deport all of them, some of you might sit there and say, oh, that's crazy. Like, would we really do that? Well, actually, we did. During the Great Depression, there was a massive deportation of Mexican Americans and other people from other Latin American countries where they were deported from the U.S. And so when we talk about these things, there's a history that we don't know about, that we're at least lacking awareness about. And some of the migration flows that happen in the U.S. is particularly salient amongst the Latino population.
From 1836 to 1914, over 30 million people immigrated to the United States. The tired, huddled masses that made Ellis Island a beacon of hope. Among the crowded faces at New York Harbor in January 1880 was a 27-year-old political exile from Cuba, José Martí.
Elsewhere, they make men flee. But here, they welcome the fleeing man with a smile.
Martí would join the earliest community of Latinos in New York, Puerto Ricans and Cubans, who had arrived along the trade routes that brought tobacco, coffee, and sugar into the U.S. As the new century dawned, many more Latinos would venture north from places linked to America by trade or taken by conquest.
This huge Latino presence in the United States is a direct result of our own nation's territorial expansion.
Tens of thousands would come from Puerto Rico, an island acquired by war in 1898. They would build a community that in time would see more Puerto Ricans in New York than on the island itself. Nearly 1 million would come from Mexico, following the tracks that brought silver and copper to America, and now provided the only escape from a violent revolution. Juan Salvador Villaseñor survives the war and achieves his own version of the American dream.
My father thought that the United States was like paradise. There was food for everyone and there was jobs for everyone.
But for a Mexican-American girl born in Los Angeles, that dream would be denied. Emilia Castañeda and her family are deported along with 500,000 Mexicans and Mexican-Americans during the Great Depression.
We had a big trunk, and the first thing my father put in there was his working tools and a couple of blankets that we had, because we lost everything.
It sets up a pattern of wanting Mexican labor at times in which employment is needed, and wanting people to just leave when that labor is no longer needed.
So when we're talking about managing workforce diversity and thinking about how do Latinos and Hispanics fit into this equation, a lot is sort of understanding part of the motivation for letting in, sort of loosening the borders for immigration, is labor demands. You know, there was high employment demands, and so it's like opening up the borders. I mean, that's what Germany is doing right now. The reason why Germany is opening their borders to all these refugees is because their population is aging out, and they don't have many young people, or proportionally young people, to pay for the Social Security for the retiring generation, and their fertility rates are below population replacement. So in a sense, in Germany, they're kind of doing the math, and they're saying, we actually could use some more skilled workers coming into Germany. But then, like in the U.S., during the time of depression, it's like, hey, there's high unemployment. Who should we get rid of? Who should we send home? And so this large swath, say 500,000 people, they just said, okay, you guys are done. We don't need you anymore. Go home. And it wasn't sort of like, we'll set you up at home. It's like, grab a suitcase and leave. And so why would one group be singled out over another group? And I think in the U.S., it's particularly salient amongst the Latino and Hispanic population, where what is immigration that's occurring, but also amongst the Latinos that live in the U.S., the population is growing exponentially. It's the fastest growing population in the U.S., and so it sort of heightens our awareness of how should the U.S. respond to this growing Latino population in terms of education, in terms of healthcare, in terms of language, like should it be in English only in the United States, or should it be more conducive for people speaking Spanish? And there's a quick infographic that gives you a sense of the population growth amongst Latinos.
From the northern tip of Washington State to the southern borders of Texas, the Hispanic population is continually growing. In all states bordering Mexico, Hispanic students are the majority at public schools, and almost 1 million Hispanics reach voting age each year now. A demographic transformation is underway. One American in six is now Hispanic, a big jump from the small minority Hispanics were only two generations ago. By mid-century, Hispanics will be more than one in four.
One of the things that I think is important to think about, when I meet someone who's of Hispanic or Latino origins, my mind gets flooded with like all these stereotypes and just assumptions of like immigrant, you got here illegally, you probably ran across the border, or it just sort of evokes a certain picture, when in reality what we see is that not all Latinos are from Mexico. I mean, you see large portions of people from Puerto Rico and Cuba have immigrated to the U.S., and a lot of them are more along the Eastern Corridor, but then also immigrants from Latin America and all the countries in Central and South America. And what I find is a part of our role as being leaders within organizations is to cut through the different stereotypes. The one way that that can be done is by engaging people on an individual level. And so, you know, the tendency sometimes is if I meet someone with Latino or Hispanic origins, is if I make these assumptions about them and I don't even ask them about their story, or I sort of fumble through a very awkward conversation of saying, well, where are you from? You know, like, how'd you get here? Assuming that they're not from here, that they weren't born here, that their family hasn't been here for four or five generations. And so a lot of times, or what I try to do in engaging people of Latino or Hispanic origins is like, where did you grow up? Is a much more inviting question, and then it lets the person self-disclose. Oh, I grew up in Chicago. Oh, tell me more about that. What was that like? Or they might say, I grew up in Mexico City. And then that, you know, gives you an opportunity then to inquire more based on the data that they've given you versus making assumptions. And then I can ask, you know, if they grew up in Mexico City, oh, well, how did you end up in the U.S.? How did you end up coming here? You have no idea. Maybe they're a scholar who got a great scholarship to study here, and that's why they're here, because they're on scholarship. Or maybe they ended up here because their parents were fleeing their part of the country to come to the U.S., and they were brought here when they were two. And they didn't really have much say in the matter. You just don't know. But the only way you can find out and begin to sort of break down the stereotypes is by asking questions that allow them to self-disclose. Versus sort of what I would say is slightly offensive or awkward questions of, where are you from? Which is sort of this indicting type of thing, or how'd you get here? Whereas making these assumptions and sort of these leading questions, which might then not even be based in reality. So my question in terms of managing workforce diversity is related to the question of immigration in the U.S. borders, and specifically related to Latinos and Hispanics. You know, the debate is, our immigration policies are too loose and we need to tighten them up, and we need to lock down the borders and let no one across. And in fact, if there's people here, that they should all be deported. I'll say the Donald Trump model of very strict borders, but not only strict borders, but also deportation, because in a sense, the argument is that Latinos are taking the jobs of hardworking Americans. I mean, I'm quoting them. I'm not sort of making that claim, because what is an American in the broader scheme of things? But so one argument is very tight borders and even deporting people. And the other argument would be, hey, listen, there was a time in the U.S. when the borders were more or less open. Open to everyone except for criminals and people who had communicable diseases. Those are the two groups that weren't necessarily let in right off the bat. They were quarantined a lot of times, or they just weren't allowed to come into the U.S. because they would be spreading communicable diseases. So I want us to line up like we've done before on where you stand in the perspective of immigration policy. If you think that the policy should become more strict and that even there's a good argument for deportation, I want you to be down at that end. And if you think, you know, my sense on it is we should just open the borders wide open and restrict it only to the cases of people who have a criminal record or might have a disease that could be, you know, like polio or something that could be spread or introduced into the U.S. environment, which we would not want. So strict people down on that end, loose people down on this end. Okay, I want to start by hearing from the strict people. Why you would feel that the immigration current immigration policies are too loose and that there's a valid and good arguments for having tighter borders?
Like, from where I'm from, like, there's a lot of tobacco farmers, and there's, like, a lot of Mexicans that just come in. And, like, it used to be, like, a lot of the locals that would just do it. But now, like, you have Mexicans that come in, like, can't speak a word of English or anything. But they take the job just because, like, they accept a lower wage. But, like, if, say you enforce it, it'll give back, you know, some of our jobs and stuff.
So in a sense, the part of the argument is they're taking jobs because they're willing to work for a lower wage.
Yeah. Now, I mean, maybe it's because, like, maybe we're spoiled or something, but, like, I guess they're glad to be here.
Sure. And if they weren't here, then there'd be higher employment amongst U.S.-born Americans. Any other arguments, sort of reasons why you just, you know, just your personal impression is, I think the borders need to be tighter. I mean, you're not alone in this. There's plenty of people in the U.S. who have this perspective. James?
Yeah, well, I just don't think it's smart to allow more people to come in where we're already having troubles with unemployment. And the economy is already awful, where if we have our own already legal citizens trying to take up jobs rather than bringing immigrants in to just add to the problem.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, those are good. You know, in my mind, I'm sitting there thinking, well, should we then restrict how many kids people should have? Because if you restrict the number of kids, then that would help the unemployment rate. The other, I mean, interesting thing that I know, the unemployment rate in the U.S. right now is 5.1%. It's pretty low, and it actually never gets to 0%. And so that's something to think about, because I know the countries in Europe have much higher unemployment rates, but there's complex dynamics with that. Any other on the stricter side that you guys can think of? Things related to education, healthcare, crime?
Well, I was just thinking from a financial perspective, like, people have to pay for all these people coming across, and I just don't find it pretty realistic to just open the floodgates to everyone. But I know, like you said, we were all immigrants at one point, so it's hard to walk that fine line.
Sure.
But just, I think taxpayers would end up having to pay for each of these people. You know, they have enough to pay for as it is.
Yeah.
For their own families and whatnot.
Yeah, I honestly don't know enough about the dynamics of who's paying taxes or who's not paying taxes, what employers, because employers pay taxes on behalf of their employees a lot of times too. And so it's like, to me, I don't know the data on when people are working, like what you're saying, Charlie, of the with the tobacco farms, like, are taxes being paid?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I can't assume that they're not being paid, but because it would be hard to imagine a U.S. company functioning and they have employees, and the IRS is going to say, you have employee, like, this product didn't come about without any type of employment.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's just straight cash. Like, it's kind of under the table.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know, and every situation is different. For people on this side who would be advocates of having looser immigration policies or at least less strict policies, what would you say? What's your reasoning?
I mean, Well, didn't the book say, like, a lot of the Hispanic population is, like, younger people, people who are just entering the workforce?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the U.S. is, like, an aging population, and we're having fewer babies. Like, we can't actually, like, sustain our population, and, like, we actually can't support our Social Security system. Like, we don't have enough money flowing in. And a lot of, like, illegal immigrants have fake Social Security numbers where they pay into the system that they'll never, ever draw out of. And so, actually, it's really, really good to have immigrants, like, they pay money into the systems that, like, pay for our grandparents' retirements. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, plus, I think, like, Silicon Valley has a lot of immigrants. Like, a lot of, like, people who are starting companies in Silicon Valley, like, really, really big companies that are getting really successful, they're immigrants. Like, I don't know. I think immigration's a good thing.
So, I mean, it is, I mean, you bring up a very complicated thing. In order to get a job, you need a Social Security number. These people might not have a Social Security number, so they get one so that they can get a job and they pay taxes with it, but it's really not them. So like what you're saying, they're not going to reap the benefits of it, but they need that Social Security number to get the job. And so they're leveraging that. Or so in a sense, they're paying taxes, they're paying into the system, but not necessarily getting the benefits of the system. It's a complicated thing. Another interesting thing is that the people who tend to migrate are the healthiest, the strongest, the most entrepreneurial amongst their population because they have the fortitude to actually move. Like if you're lazy or sick or someone of that disposition, you're not going to immigrate. You won't have the fortitude. I mean, if you guys have seen the stuff that's going on in Europe right now, what it takes to immigrate is incredibly gruesome and challenging. And so for someone to be able to actually survive that, there's something about their constitution that enables them to overcome the challenges of actually migrating. So it's always this interesting statistic that the health outcomes of immigrants are always consistently better than the population that they immigrate to. And people are like, well, how are immigrants healthier than the people in the United States? Well, it's because it's a selection of the type of people who end up immigrating are of a certain constitution and fortitude that enables them to succeed in the immigration process. Other people that have perspective on opening borders.
Yeah. I kind of look at it from more of like an economic standpoint. Like if, for example, an immigrant can work for a lower wage than, say, an American citizen, then that's what the markets demand, so that's like how it should be, you know, because
mm-hmm.
in America you have like a free labor market system. So if you're trying to like say like an immigrant can work at this position, but like rather an American should, you're kind of just like degrading the system that like America was kind of founded upon, I guess, where it's just like free market.
Mm-hmm.
That's like my perspective.
Yeah. What are you gonna say?
And immigrants take jobs that Americans don't want anyway, like housekeeping, like just like really, really unskilled labor jobs like Americans don't want anyway, so like why not?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and again, in every case there's counter arguments to that, because even what you're saying of like, well, if they're willing to work for a lower wage, but in the US they're passing legislation of minimum hourly wages. You know, in New York I think it's gonna be up to $15 an hour. And so then all of a sudden you have this increase or surge of immigrants who qualify for these jobs, and then their sort of competitive advantage of working for a lower rate gets undermined, and so then they're competing as equals, taking the same wages. And so in some ways, I mean, it's just much more complex than how can someone come into the U.S. and take these jobs and because they're willing to work for lower pay and worse conditions. But in a sense, labor laws change to say, hey, you can't even hire someone for a lower wage or worse conditions. Like, everyone has to have a level playing field. So, I mean, from my perspective, yes, Ashlyn.
Well, I was just going to say that I kind of agree with what you said. If someone has, like, the drive to come here, like, migrate over here, it probably is because they're desperate, you know, to change their life for the better.
Mm-hmm.
So why, deny someone who is either, you know, in danger or helpless?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there's a a very good argument for that. In the midst of that, though, other people take advantage of the system and say their vocation is selling drugs, and they see a thriving market in the U.S., and so they're going to come in sort of on the tails of people who are trying to escape a desperate situation.
Yeah, but I feel like that applies to literally everything. Like, there's always going to be that percentile that, you know, cheats the system.
Sure.
And ruins it for everyone. But overall, I think that, you know, those people that are trying to come over and really better themselves should not be, you know, denied that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, again, it's a very complex thing, and I think my main point is it isn't sort of a straightforward black and white, like, oh, you know, unemployment is high, so we should stop immigration, or these people are willing to do jobs that we aren't willing to do, so we should let them in. I mean, it's incredibly complex, and sort of the starting point is recognizing the complexity and then thinking about, well, how do all these moving pieces work together, and how does it impact me if I'm an employer and looking to give a response to immigration policy or hiring people who are immigrants or hiring Latinos and Hispanics. So we can sit back down. So another thing related to population growth, a lot of you asked questions in the memo of saying, like, why is the median age for Latinos 27.4 when for the rest of the U.S. population, I think it's some level of the 30s? And part of it is partially an immigration story, that if someone is only a first or second generation person in the U.S., what it means is that their parents or their grandparents or even their aunts and uncles aren't here in the U.S. And their parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles are typically older. And if they were here in the U.S., then the median age would rise up. Because, like, perhaps most of you in this room, you have parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles who are in the U.S., and so when they say, what's the median age of the white population in the U.S., it's being balanced out by the multi-generations of your family that lives here in the U.S. Another thing is simply fertility rates. So fertility rates amongst Latino population is higher than it is amongst the Caucasian population. So if someone is having more children, those children pull down the median age of a certain population. So some of you are asking that question, and it's really a demographic answer of both realities of immigration and fertility rates. Another question that a lot of you brought up was related to what's the difference between Hispanics and Latinos, and what's the story behind that? And there's this professor at Berkeley who wrote an amazing book on this topic, and it's basically this historical account of the making of the Hispanic population. And it's a political sociological account of how did the term Hispanic come to be, and how did it come to dominate our vocabulary for referring to a certain population of people that span a wide spectrum of countries of origin. And she was interviewed recently about the book, and in the interview she gives, from my perspective, one of the best explanations of deciphering between Latino and Hispanic and the political implications for this shift of self-identifying an entire population as being Hispanic and sort of the political motivations for that. And we're going to watch a clip of her interview.
The journey of writing this book really gave me a deep appreciation for the struggle of representation in America. I grew up in the Los Angeles area in a place that was almost 100% Mexican. And I remember thinking growing up that diversity around the neighborhood was what part of Mexico your parents were from. It wasn't until I moved to the East Coast for graduate school that I realized that Latino-ness might have a different hue. All of a sudden, I'd walk around the city, and people might guess or people might ask me what part of Puerto Rico I was from. And it was in thinking about how amazingly different this experience of being Latino was for me on the East Coast is that I began to think about how incredibly odd that we all still belong to the same category. Someone that might have just migrated from Mexico one day was in the exact same category with someone whose grandparents were from Puerto Rico. and the food was different, the experiences were different, perhaps ways of speaking Spanish was quite different as well. From Washington's perspective, they tended to think of Chicanos as a real regional issue. It was something for state policy. But Chicanos realized if they could reframe their issues and not necessarily just make them Mexican-American issues, but perhaps join with Puerto Ricans, then that was something that Washington now needed to pay attention to, because Hispanics connoted a national minority, you know, East Coast and West Coast. It wasn't just a regional phenomenon. When you now say, for example, that Hispanics are a 50 million plus population, that's power. Striving towards one national image, while it gives you power, you also run the risk of homogenizing incredibly important differences. I often get the question, what term is better, Hispanic or Latino? The Hispanic term is mostly a sense of community through a connection to Spain. It's the notion that Latin Americans are tied culturally to Spaniards. The term Latino is mostly defined as a sense of community through a history of colonization from Spain. And so the basis of unity is politically different on both levels. But now many of the major Hispanic or Latino institutions use both interchangeably. They might call themselves Latino in one press release and then Hispanic on their website. And it speaks, I think, to the way that the category has become so deeply ingrained in much of American life.
That underlying argument was still around.
I think before it was easy to just sort of think that Hispanic category was something that was imposed on Latinos in the United States by the government or by bureaucrats, but it was in understanding the stories and the struggle of activists to actually get attention onto these issues that I realized that there's more of a story here about representation and about a fight for recognition.
You know, to me, what's interesting, especially on the West Coast, it's almost predominantly the references to Latinos. But then when I moved to the East Coast, the self-description was Hispanics. But then also when I was in LA, in Southern California, I would hear Chicano more often as a self-reference. And one thing that I found interesting with Moore's book is that part of the reason of putting everyone under the Hispanic umbrella is to consolidate power. So if you're just sort of from Ecuador and you're trying to organize the Ecuadorian Americans, it's a smaller population, or Peruvian or Argentinian. But if you can consolidate the entire Latin American communities that are in the U.S., you actually have more leverage and more power. And that's sort of what this Hispanic movement was done. So you'll notice when you fill out the census, the U.S. Census, or almost any government document, it now asks you, first question about race and ethnicity is, are you Hispanic? And then it'll say, and what is your race? And so to me, that's an indication of incredible power, that they actually changed the census and how we reference people. And part of it is that people get discriminated against based on their race. And so by being able to categorize a group of people as Hispanic and actually being Hispanic and white begins to level the playing field of people and give recognition to this community that has been marginalized or victimized in different ways. And so to me, it's an interesting story, an interesting socio-political story in regards to the Latino and Hispanic population. And it's true, though, we see this also amongst Asian Americans, and we're going to cover that group next week. But Asian Americans, you know, is a very pan-Asian categorization, because within that you have Vietnamese, you have Korean-American, Japanese-American, but if you can identify with a larger group of people, then your political power increases. But what Professor Mora talked about is that when you do that, you lose individuality. So the unique distinctions from being from different countries gets overlooked or minimized. And so a lot of times, like we said, We just think, oh, you're Hispanic, but we don't think about, well, but what's your family's country of origin, and what are the implications of that? Because if you're an immigrant from Cuba, it's very different from being an immigrant from Argentina. You might even be a political refugee from Cuba versus someone from Argentina. You might have come here because you're working in the high-tech industry, and you have a special visa that allows you to come here to the U.S. So part of it is what's your country of origin? And, you know, again, a lot of you said in the memos that, well, when I hear the term Hispanic or I see someone who's Latino, I just think Mexican. And that's just where my mind goes. And I'm kind of just curious to know, what are some of the negative stereotypes of Latinos that you hear either in the media or that you might read somewhere or just hear on campus? Like some of the more negative stereotypes. What are some of the things that you hear on the street, the associations? Yes.
That, like, it's like a whole bunch of people living in one house.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, lots of people in one house. What other negative stereotypes do you hear? Yes.
A lot of them are criminals.
Criminals. Olivia.
Landscapers.
Uh-huh. Landscapers. What other? Yes.
Get paid under the table.
Paid under the table. Any other stereotypes that you hear? Trent?
They take advantage of, like, the healthcare system.
Uh-huh. Parasites of the healthcare system. What's interesting with these stereotypes and with all stereotypes, there is elements of truth. Sort of as Ashley was saying, that there's always going to be some people who take advantage of the system. But then to have them be representative, as we all know with any stereotype, is just inaccurate. And I think, for me, the Latinos that I know, part of my exploration, most of the stuff I just don't understand. I don't know what percentage of the population fits this stereotype and what percentage doesn't fit it. And, you know, it's hard to gather data on this. I mean, I think one of the complexities of this is, like, how do you research a population of illegal immigrants? If you're wanting to gather data on how many illegal immigrants are in the U.S., how would you do that? I mean, would you put an ad in the paper that says, I'm doing a study on illegal immigrants, please come to my house on Tuesday so I can interview you? Or you walk into a classroom. At IU, I guarantee you, there are people who are here by way of illegal means, even students at IU. Do you think they're going to self-identify their status, their immigration status? So part of it is we don't know. We don't know what percentage of the population, and let's say amongst the Latino population, what percentage are here illegally. And yet we have this sort of inflated impression that, well, it's a lot, or it's the majority, or, you know, how else would you get here? And then other things, you know, are they paid under the table? Yes.
How do they actually get, like, the number? Because, like, you hear, like, you see the stats, like, however million illegal immigrants, how do they come to that number?
There's high margin of error in those estimates. I mean, part of it would be looking, I mean, they have cameras to look over the border to see how many people have come over, so, but that's not everyone that's coming over illegally. They also look at deportation records, so like arrest, when they arrest someone and the person doesn't have documents. So they take those numbers and then they adjust them based on certain population estimates. So they have some data through, you know, seeing people who cross illegally and also people who get arrested in the U.S. and they find out, okay, you are illegal, you're here illegally. But those numbers are actually fairly small, and so then they adjust those numbers to think, well, you know, they make projections of, well, if we know this many were arrested, then there's a potential that there's this many who are here illegally. But part of it is thinking creative. I mean, this is true for any research of hard-to-reach populations. Another one is what percentage of the population is HIV positive? It's another question that people want to know, but again, people aren't raising their hands saying, I'm HIV positive, or, you know, if I say, hey, by the way, at the end of class, I'm doing a study on everyone who's HIV positive. Can you guys raise your hand if you're HIV positive? You guys aren't going to do that. But from a public health perspective, it's incredibly important to know the statistics of who's HIV positive, and does that vary by class, and does that vary by race? So I would argue that a part of having good public policy and even good labor policy is, first of all, knowing the facts. Like, what is reality? Even if that reality is hard to acquire, in order to make good policy, you need to know what reality is versus sort of making assumptions. Like, you know, in a sense, when Trump says we need to deport all these people because they're criminals and they're rapists and they steal all our jobs, well, what percentage of the Latino immigrants have a criminal record? You know, that would be important to know. And if 95% of them do, then yeah, maybe that's a good policy. But if only 2% of them do, then that would sort of change our perspective. So I would argue that it's a very good endeavor to make attempts. So then part of it is becoming creative in collecting that data. But I would argue that it's incredibly invaluable to have that data, to just know what percentage of the people came here illegally, what percentage came here through different legal means. And so that information is hard to acquire, but it's important. And I think in terms of our experience, again, I go back to, you want large-scale data sets, but you also just want on-the-ground qualitative data. And, you know, amongst the Latinos that I know, again, inquiring, asking questions. Like, this is your opportunity. And especially here at college, if you meet someone who's Latino, and actually most of you had said, I don't know many Latino students on campus. And yet they're the second largest student group on this campus. And for me, I had a friend, Manuel, who did landscaping. And, you know, he was born in Mexico City. He came to the United States. I asked him about how he ended up coming to North Carolina, and he had family that was in North Carolina, so North Carolina was a logical place. I also know that just a year ago, his wife became a U.S. citizen. Like, she went through all the classes and then took the test and then did the oath of becoming a U.S. citizen, but then Manuel hadn't become a citizen yet. I don't know what his status is, but I know there's like a huge celebration that his wife became a U.S. citizen. I don't know the circumstances of how does one person get to become a U.S. citizen and another one doesn't. I know that his education level was a fourth grade education level. I suspect it was because he left Mexico when he was in the fourth grade, and imagine coming to the U.S. and then trying to get, or I don't know if he left at fourth grade, but he stopped education in fourth grade. And so it's hard to then enter into a school system, especially if you're older, where you don't know English, and then to get a high school degree is very difficult. So when we talk about why the education level of Latinos is so much lower than the rest of the U.S. population, well, part of it is the immigration story, and what education level did you have in your home country? That's probably what your education level stayed at. Now, Manuel, he works full-time during the day, he has two kids, but he's also working on getting his GED. So he's at night taking classes at a community college, which costs money. And so, you know, part of it is just, he's one person, he's not representative. I don't want to make him a stereotype of all Latinos. But for me, as a leader or potential employer, it's just helpful to know the incredible complexities of the story. Now, Manuel knows English a lot better than his wife does. But his wife is now the U.S. citizen. Manuel has a driver's license, but, you know, when he was going to take the driver's exam, the driver's manual was in English, and it was also in Spanish, but for some reason, only the first three chapters of the driver's manual had been translated into Spanish, and they hadn't, I don't know exactly the full story, but basically he didn't have access to all seven chapters when he was doing the driving exam, and I found that just really interesting that it was only halfway done. And actually, I don't know what his reading level in Spanish is. Like, we would think, oh, if you're fluent in Spanish, you're literate in Spanish. But if you only have a fourth grade education level, chances are you might not be able to read in Spanish. You might be able to speak it, because it's easier to do that, but you might not be able to read, and maybe even your writing ability is limited as well. I asked Manuel about his vocational aspirations, and he wants to own his own business, his own landscaping business. It's something that he loves to do, but the likelihood of him being able to do that is very slim. His employer, the owner of the landscaping business, is a Caucasian, And Manuel said that the two most challenging things in regards to going off on his own and starting his own business is the language barriers. It's hard for him to negotiate contracts. So if you're a landscaper and you're trying to get a bid for a contract, you have to negotiate. And so you're negotiating with potentially someone who's fluent in English, and if your English ability is more limited, it's going to hinder you in the negotiation process and even in the bidding process of knowing how to bid a job, because you don't want to underbid, and then you know you get in there and you're in a situation where you offer to do it for a very low price, and then you realize, oh shoot, I can't afford this. And so for him, it's actually safer, more conservative for him to continue working for this same employer because it's consistent guaranteed pay. But if he could, if he had the capital to invest in the assets to actually open up his own landscaping business, that would be his desire and his ambition. Part of it is he doesn't have a high school degree. That's why he wants to get his GED. And he also wants to learn how to be literate in English so that he can write up contracts. And so this is just one example, but I think it's an example that every one of us can engage in. And everyone's story is going to be different. He also has a child who's in second grade, and my son is in second grade. We read to our kid every night. You know, that's just part of the bedtime routine. We read stories. And I know that in his experience, a lot of times the books that his second grader will bring home to read, the second grader is more able to read those books in English than Manuel is. And so you think about educational disparities. My child has an incredible advantage because of the home environment of just the fact that English is my first language. And so reading to my kid at night and helping him to learn how to read puts my kid at an incredible advantage compared to Manuel's kid. So should that be a strike against Manuel? Does he have a profile where we'd say, you know, come on, your kid should study harder. Why is your kid not performing as well in school? The second grader, he's just trying to do as best he can. I actually can get by with just having one job. Manuel has multiple jobs. He does landscaping, he does other jobs on the side, and he's also going to school getting his GED. So there's this incredible complex story for anyone, but particularly people who are immigrants, where there's many more hurdles that they're having to overcome. And I think part of the value is a lot of times we don't know all the data, and sometimes just raw numbers aren't very impactful. But individual stories begin to paint a picture of what does it mean to be Latino or a Latino immigrant in the U.S., to be a first-generation or second-generation immigrant. And this is where you, if you're interested, have the opportunity to begin to ask questions. Part of it is just sort of coming alongside someone who is Latino and just sort of saying, hey, you know, forging a friendship or some type of connection. Maybe it's someone that's at work that you just haven't talked to. And you're like, huh, let's go get lunch. Or let's go do something. Like, what's your story? I'm ignorant, and my ignorance doesn't help me to be successful in life and in community. And I just want to know. That one story won't be the total story, but at least it'll be cumulatively gathering more and more information about a population that you know less about or that you're sort of driven by stereotypes. There's an interesting thing. When I lived in California, there's this one street, 4th Street, where if you drove by there around 7 a.m., you would see just people standing around, more or less waiting for work, and it's the day laborer. And a part of it is it's like, what? Who are these people? How does this system work? You know, when you pick them up, do you negotiate the price right there when you pick them up? Do they get paid every day? What happens if they get injured on the job? But there's enough going on to where they every day go out there looking for work. And so even if the situation is bad, the people are saying, but it's not too bad such that I'm going to stop looking for work. There's an interesting organization that tries to organize people who are day laborers, and they put together a promotional clip that puts a human face to some of these day laborers in their community.
You've probably heard of day laborers, but have you heard from them?
My name is Nelson.
My name is Maria.
My name is Emmanuel.
I'm available every day to get the job done.
My name is Bridget.
My name is Juan. You can depend on me.
My name is Marta.
I'm trustworthy.
I am dependable.
At your local day labor center, we build community and get the job done.
So again, a part of it is you know, my experience is I see people on the street who are day laborers, and then I have certain perceptions or views of who those people are, and yet I don't know. I don't know their story. I don't know their situation. I don't know how long they've been doing that. I don't know what their aspirations are. I don't know what their family situation is. I don't know how they ended up being a day laborer. But there is an incredibly rich story behind every person. A friend of mine, she was a high school student. Her name is Beatrice, and I'd gotten to know her basically when she was in eighth grade, and our family had gotten to know her, and she was just this very vibrant, charismatic woman. And she was approaching graduation, and I said, you know, what are you going to do when you graduate? And she said, well, I'm going to go to UNAM. And UNAM, for those of you who don't know, is the premier university in Mexico City. It's a great university. And I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. Like, how'd you decide to do that? And she said, well, because it's the only university I can afford. And I was thinking, like, well, what do you mean it's the only university you can afford? And she said, well, because in North Carolina, the DREAM Act hasn't been passed. And so if I wanted to go to a public university in North Carolina, I would have to pay out-of-state tuition. And just like here in Indiana, out-of-state tuition is really expensive. In-state tuition is expensive, but out-of-state is even more expensive. So here's someone who is a North Carolina resident, graduated from high school in North Carolina, but the availability to go to school in North Carolina as an in-state resident was just not an option. And she was just like, my option is to go back to Mexico City and enroll in the university there. And you could just sort of sense, like, she's like, well, that's just reality. That's you know, that's the only option. She wasn't like bitter or sort of like, hey, demanding her rights, but it was more, my whole family is here in North Carolina, but I have to go back and enroll at UNAM. And then I saw her 3 months later, and I was like, hey, so when are you going back to Mexico City? And she's like, no, I get to stay. And apparently, during the course of that time, the DREAM Act, and the DREAM Act, one aspect of the DREAM Act is basically giving the opportunity for young people in the U.S. who are immigrants the opportunity to get in-state tuition, but it's a state-by-state policy. And apparently, it had been changed in North Carolina over this short period, and she was able to enroll in a university in North Carolina, and you could just see this sense of like relief and excitement. It's like, ah, like now I can do this. And like to me, I was like, when I went to university, it was like I had the luxury of choosing, and because I could do in-state residency, it was like just a simple process for me of deciding. And yet when we talk about education levels and quality of education, there's things in our policy that affect the education level of people who are immigrants. And I'll show one more video that gives information on the DREAM Act and its implications.
My family brought me from San Pedro Sula, Honduras when I was 4 years old. I learned English in 5 months and graduated high school with a grade point average of 3.8. Due to the immigration laws in my state, I have not been able to go to college. I'm working and working, but it feels like it's toward nothing.
I came from Medellin, Colombia 12 years ago. Going back isn't a choice because I only have a third grade reading level in Spanish.
I honestly can't picture my life in Honduras, being that I don't know anything different from what I'm used to here.
I'm part of the American culture, and this country is where I had the opportunity to meet my amazing friends who shaped me to who I am today.
Again, you asked about education levels in the U.S. amongst the Latino population. there's policies in place that make it much more difficult for undocumented immigrants than it does for other people who don't have that barrier to education. Now, these people could get education, it's just a lot more expensive, and we don't have those barriers. A lot of you asked in your memos for clarification regarding the DREAM Act and what it is state by state. And essentially, the DREAM Act is a way for undocumented immigrants to potentially acquire in-state tuition and financial aid, but it's decided state by state. There's also federal legislation that's going on, but that's a much slower process. And so each state has sort of adopted their own policy in the meantime. But especially when you think of like colleges and community colleges, tuition is based on your state. You know, if you're in-state resident, then you get certain tuition rates, and then if you're out of state, you pay a higher rate. But what I found was interesting is that it's much more involved than what I had initially thought, that it isn't just whether you get in-state tuition or not, but it also affects whether you get financial aid, and then also you could be neutral on it, and apparently that's what North Carolina is right now, is that I don't know exactly if undocumented immigrants get in-state tuition or not. It's just sort of, there's no legislation, so I'm not sure what the policy is, but then some actively ban in-state tuition, and then other states ban enrollment altogether if you're undocumented. And so part of that is when you're filling out an application, sometimes you need to put down a social security number or other type of documentation establishing your residency. What I find interesting about this debate is that I graduated high school in upstate New York, and I went to school out in California. And part of the reason I chose to go to school out there to a public university was that back then, after the first year, you could become an in-state resident and get in-state tuition. I would have never have done it had I had to pay out-of-state tuition. And so people would say, well, goodness, you stole from the system because you didn't grow up paying taxes in California, and then you get this really cut-rate education for 4 years. But then in reality, I graduated, and I stayed in California for several years and worked. And not only that, both my brothers ended up moving out to California, and then my parents moved out to California, and a handful of my cousins moved out to California as a result of all this. It wasn't just because of me, but it's just the family kind of was like, hey, this is kind of nice out here. And so what ended up happening, even though I didn't pay into the system on the front end, on the back end, not only myself, but several family members who were all working in California were paying taxes. And so, you know, you could have a short-sighted vision of like, well, you know, if these people haven't been paying into the system on the front end, why should we give them a discounted tuition? But if you have a college-educated person in your state, they're going to be getting a job oftentimes in that same state and paying back into the system. And so it isn't as just straightforward as, well, if you haven't been paying taxes, then you shouldn't have in-state tuition. There are definitely incentives to saying, hey, let's invite people into our state and give them a more discounted rate for the long-term benefits of it. So, but I wanted to sort of clarify some of that. Another thing that is part of Latinos and Hispanics is related to English-only laws. And again, these are state-by-state laws where the state can decide how much do they want just English as the only language that's spoken and written in their state, or do they want to expand to have multiple languages. And I came across this political campaign ad from 2010. It was a Republican primary candidate for governor of Alabama. I'm going to show this video just as a picture of what options are out there, and then we can talk about what the implications of English-only laws.
I'm Tim James. Why do our politicians make us get driver's license exams in 12 languages? This is Alabama. We speak English. If you want to live here, learn it. We're only giving that test in English, if I'm governor. Maybe it's the businessman in me, but we'll save money. And it makes sense. Does it to you?
Tim James did not win the Republican primaries, but I find it interesting that that's a pretty provocative campaign ad. And he just didn't do it blindly, but he did market research to sort of realize there's a clear constituency out there that would rally behind him in this promotion of English only. I felt it was fairly in your face. Some of you in this room might fully agree with him, and that's fine. But what I see, especially being at a place like SPIA, that when you think about communicating with the broader public, whether it be related to public health issues or education or any type of public sector activity, that there's value in the message getting out. And I think about it as being someone who's traveled to other countries. When those countries have things written in English, I am very thankful because I'm lost. When I go into another country and I don't speak that language, it's very helpful, especially things related to emergency evacuation issues or directions or even instructions for different things. So it's easy on one level to say, well, hey, this is America, you should speak English. But generally, when we go to other countries, we think, hey, how come you don't have this in English as well? Like, I'm here and I need some help. So there's arguments for both sides. There's clearly costs involved in translating all the materials. And even with that, you don't necessarily stop just Spanish, but would you do Chinese and other populations that have large representation in the U.S.? And so for you, unless you go into public policy, you'll have to decide on a smaller level. If you're running a business or running a community organization, you'll have to decide that question. One of the groups that I study is immigrant rights organizations. And what I find very fascinating on two levels is that here's these organizations that are working for immigrant rights. And one thing that I observed is that amongst their leadership, they often have very few immigrants represented amongst their leadership. So here they are, an organization that's representing and advocating for immigrant rights, and yet amongst their leadership, they don't have immigrants. And beyond that, you go to their website or you go to their promotional material, and it's all in English. And so some of my other colleagues have sat in on these meetings of so should we upgrade our website to have it be Spanish and English, or should it be just Spanish, or should we extend it to other languages? And so as an organization, they're having to decide, should we allocate resources to expanding our language base given the goals and the mission of our organization? And so for you, this is a very salient issue. Even your applications, say you're hiring, do you have applications that are multilingual? It's something to consider, especially when we talk about Hispanics and Latinos or other immigrants where English is not their first language. But in general, this is not a public policy class, so I'm going to throw out there the public policy issues that are being debated, whether it be immigration or English only or other things that are out there. And mainly my desire is to show both sides so that you can just, in a sense, be aware, oh yeah, I guess there is two sides to this story or to this debate. And maybe I've only been exposed to one perspective. But in regards to managing diversity, I think an important thing for me to communicate is the benefits of diversity. Because a lot of times society is skewed towards homogeneity, and you need some sort of, what are the economic and social benefits of being diverse? In regards to the Latino population, I find this very interesting. So my cousin lives in San Diego, and he used to work for the San Diego Padres. And he was the promotions director. You know, part of his job was to decide who throws out the first pitch and who sings the national anthem. But it is also this larger scale job of, like, how do you create more Padre fans, basically. One of the things that he implemented, and it was part of bringing in a whole team of people to focus on the Mexican population specifically, because San Diego is right on the border. And there's a lot of people who are potentially interested in baseball, especially in the Latin American countries and particularly in Mexico. And his team came up with this plan, and his team was a mixture of U.S.-born and Mexican leaders. And one of the things they said was not only just sort of doing commercials down there, but let's bring the Padres to Mexico. And so they set up these special games to be played down in Mexico, which was this fantastic promotional scheme of building up a big fan base amongst the Mexican population. And I think about that in the sense of that idea was generated by some of the Mexican leaders who are saying it's very hard to come to a Padres game when it's in San Diego. But the real magic of becoming a baseball fan is going to the stadium and watching the game. So if it's hard for them to come to watch a game or a large swath of people to come to the game, let's bring the game to them. And that'll generate this incredible fan base, and the people will love it. and you'll have loyal fans, and you'll expand your customer base way beyond what you already had with just people in San Diego. Now, that's one example of when you have a diverse leadership team, and specifically if you have Latinos on your leadership team and listening to their ideas and listening through the logistical challenges of getting to a baseball game or crossing the border to get to a baseball game or even the cost of a ticket to go to a game, you begin to see, okay, there's other options, there's other possibilities. From a public sector, so there's economic benefits, but there's also social benefits. Ironically, my other cousin, who lives in San Diego, all of us moved to California, she's a physician assistant, and she works in a health clinic that's in a low-income area where I think 80% of her constituents only speak Spanish. She's Caucasian, but she's fluent in Spanish. And one of the things that fascinates her in working with this population is the invaluableness of her being able to communicate to her patients in Spanish. Because when she's talking about things related to family planning or healthy diets or even things related to domestic violence, these are very sensitive issues and ones that could even be very complicated to talk about if English isn't your first language. And so she can sit down with her patients and communicate with them freely in Spanish about all these different resources that are available to the patients and even alternative ways of thinking about diet and alternative ways of thinking about raising their children. And what I find is that if the clinic was an English-only clinic, a lot of the Spanish-speaking people wouldn't come. Or if they would come, they wouldn't disclose that they didn't know how to communicate in English. They would just sort of be very polite and nod and say yes, and then walk out the door without having gained the benefits of learning this health information. So not only speaking in Spanish, but then having the resources in Spanish in a context where you have a high population of people where English is not their first language. So, I mean, I think whether you're in the private sector and you're thinking about what are the economic benefits of having a diverse leadership team, I think there's good argument or cases for having diversity specifically amongst Latinos and Hispanics, but also in the public sector. The drawback that I see, and so I work for an organization that it was a national organization that really wanted to become more diverse, but we struggled. We were a very white organization. And so whenever we could recruit a minority, a person of color, to our organization, it was a big win, and it was sort of like this is showing us the potential to become more diverse on a much broader base. And there was one woman that worked on my team, and her name was Olivia, and she was fascinating. She was Mexican-American, went to school in California, and then decided to work for our organization, and she was an incredible leader. I mean, a very articulate, very strategic, very passionate person. But what I found was, is that because she was a woman and she was Latina, she was called upon to fill every different leadership spot or panel or national spokesperson role. And so as I was doing my job, my scope of responsibilities was pretty narrow. But because of her unique position in the organization and the fact that she was a minority, a true minority in our organization, she got called on. Whenever they needed someone from the Latina perspective, she was asked to fly out to be a speaker at the conference. Or there's a time for women's leadership development, and so she got called to go to that conference as well. There's a big national convention, and they needed an MC to be the MC for the big convention. And so they wanted a person of color up on stage, and so since she got called to be the MC for that. And after a couple years of this, I would talk to her, and she's just like, I'm exhausted. I mean, I can't even do my job, my local level job, because I'm being pulled in all these different directions. She goes, I like the attention, but I can't get my job done, because I'm all of a sudden the poster child for this organization and the representative of not only a person of color, but a female leader, and in a sense, my performance is being hindered. Meanwhile, here I am, just the white male doing my job, and it's a pretty focused job. She is being pulled in multiple directions, and as a result, her performance is lower than mine. So then you could say, well, there must be differences in capacities or abilities. But if you look at it sociologically, she's being pulled in multiple directions and being asked to do a lot more things because of the very fact that she's a person of color, and in this particular organization because she was a woman, and she was always being called upon. And so there's this challenge that if you're leading an organization and you have a minority in your organization, you almost need to protect them from being pulled in multiple directions, because they're going to be, you know, even at this university, if there's a panel or if there's a committee, they'll be thinking, oh, we need a person of color. Well, if you already have a few number of people who are people of color, those people are going to be called upon multiple times relative to the majority population, where I might only be called upon once in a couple of years to be on a panel, whereas that person of color or the minority will be the go-to person every time. So just in the sense of thinking about not only the benefits, but also the potential drawbacks or liabilities that we might not be cognizant of, but if we're a leader of an organization, I think it's imperative to be sensitive to those things.